We'll call the committee meeting to order and ask Mr. Wallstedt to take the roll.
Senator Hoag.
Here.
Senator Burkhardt.
Here.
Senator Cook.
Good morning.
Senator Dotsenrod.
Here.
Senator Lafine.
Here.
Senator Elke. Senator, I saw Senator Elke here this morning, didn't I? Oh, we'll say present. Okay. Senator Sorbark. Representative Hedlund.
Here.
Representative Ballou. Representative Belter.
Here.
Representative Drovdahl.
Present.
Representative Prostep.
Here.
Representative Hansen.
Here.
Representative Halstead.
Here.
Representative Holman.
Here.
Representative Casper. Representative Meyer.
Here.
Representative Nathy.
Here.
Representative Nelson.
Here.
Representative Owens.
Here.
Representative Straley.
Here.
Wow, that is excellent attendance, and it's a quorum.
Oh, great, great, great. Okay, committee members, as you can see, we've got a lot of agenda items, and I have promised that we're going to stick to that 2 o'clock adjournment because we have a lot of folks that came a long way, and the weather isn't the best, so we're going to try to stick to that schedule if we can. Having said that, I got one departure from the agenda. I wondered, Senator Sorbach, do you want to report on the UND-NDSU basketball game?
Depends what view you
want. Well, okay. Let's jump right into the 9:05 agenda item.
Mr. Chairman, just
okay. See, I'm trying to push things along, but yeah. Minutes. Has everybody had an opportunity to review the minutes and determine whether they're accurate? I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes. Representative Meyer. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the minutes are approved as presented. Now we'll go to the 9:05 agenda item. Presentation by the council staff of a bill draft to provide a 2013-15 property tax relief on the same basis as the 2011 House Bill 1047.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, the bill draft before you is a little unusual looking because it doesn't have overstrike underscore. The reason is that I put all of the sections of the chapter on property tax relief in here because they're all fair game for consideration, but until the committee suggests any changes that might be necessary, this is an ongoing law, and if no changes are made, really all that would be necessary is the funding and appropriation and any set aside. So anyway, you've seen this before, but let's just take a quick walk through. First section of the bill, the Appropriations Committee in the last session made some changes. In the previous session, the property tax relief money was set aside in the Property Tax Relief Sustainability Fund by a special provision in the bill. Now it would be by a statutory provision, and this is the one place where I did plug in an amendment because the estimated funding for 2015-17, those numbers sound funny to me, but it's $403,407,000. That is the estimate for the upcoming biennium, and that is the amount that would be set aside for the 2015-17 biennium. So that is the change there on page one. The second section is a definition section. Probably not necessary for the committee to make changes there. Third section is the mill levy reduction allocation and grant for schools. The payments for most school districts, almost all and maybe all now, beginning on line 16 down to line 20. That is what the grant will be. Taxable valuation from the prior year times the number of mills determined by subtracting 100 from the combined education rate for tax year 2008. That was the first base year used in this property tax relief method, and it is still the number of mills that those districts that in 2008 were in the range from 110 to 175 mills. That is still the number that determines the relief for those districts. Districts that were at 175 or more are under subsection C, they're on lines 19 and 20. 75 mills, that's the maximum number of mills of relief for a school district. Now, a new provision was added in 2011. That is subsection 4 on line 23. The grant to a district can't go up from its previous year grant by a percentage that exceeds the average statewide valuation increase. So what it is, it's a cap on rising valuations, that the increase has to be capped at whatever statewide average valuation increase is. And on line 21, the grant to a district can't be less than the grant in the preceding year. So the grant for a school can't go down. let's see. Bottom of page 2, top of page 3. That is the language that was added to take care of special property types that are not cut and dried run-of-the-mill property tax, some form of special separate taxation, but they are subject to tax in some form and have to be considered in the relief, so they're all listed in that subsection. Let's jump down to bottom of page 3, school district levy compliance section. To receive a grant, qualifying district must establish a spending level that doesn't result in general fund mill rate exceeding 110 mills. Okay, then the exceptions. Always exceptions to things, but actually not a lot of exceptions. Voter approval for a higher levy, one exception. School district reorganization, another exception. The higher levy doesn't exceed 571501.1, and that is the limit that is not in mills but in dollars levied compared to the highest of the past 3 years. That subdivision probably does not come into play. It differs from using a mill levy limit because under that dollar cap, new property added is a growth factor. Valuation increases of existing property is not a growth factor under that approach. So my guess is this subdivision will only come into play if a district has a declining valuation, and this is a protection for those kinds of districts, that a declining valuation will not reduce the grant amount or the amount they can levy in dollars. The second subsection here, it relates to unlimited levy approval, and at the expiration of that, approval of an excess levy of a specified amount. Those kinds of things can be approved for 5 years at a time, no longer. So that is dealt with in, well, like lines 12 to 26 on page 4. The levy reduction priority, when the funds are received by the district, this just indicates that, first of all, the relief is applied against the general fund mill rate. When that gets zeroed out, if it does, then it goes against the high school tuition levy, and if that gets zeroed out, whatever's left goes against the transportation levy. And then Section 6 of the draft is the appropriation, $403 million. That was the estimated amount for the upcoming biennium for continuation of relief on the same basis, which is what this draft would do, because it doesn't change any of the existing laws. And then there is a transfer provision because last session, $341 million was set aside in the sustainability fund, so it would now be transferred to the general fund and made available for appropriation, and the appropriation is there in Section 6, and it goes to the Superintendent of Public Instruction for distribution. So that's it. I think you're all pretty familiar with how this works. So anyway, I can address any questions that the committee might have.
Before we take questions from the committee and discussion, why don't we invite any interested persons that want to comment from the public that want to comment on this bill draft, and then we'll follow that up with committee discussion and questions.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the Taxation Committee. My name is Brian Dukscher. I'm the Superintendent of Schools in Tarrington, North Dakota. I'm here today to express two concerns with the property tax relief bill, House Bill 1047. My first concern, before this legislation was enacted, all school districts had a 185 mil maximum general fund levy. House Bill 1047 capped since House Bill 1047, the Carrington School District, along with other school districts, are now capped or lower than the previous 185 mils. Due to House Bill 1047, the Carrington School District has a new maximum mil levy of 169.69 mils, while our neighboring school district operates at 185 mils. House Bill 1047 legislation has created an inequity in the maximum operating potential of neighboring school districts. One district can educate their students at a 185 mil levy, while others, the neighboring school district, has to operate at a lower maximum mil levy. This inequity needs to be corrected. The Carrington School District, as well as other districts, made you aware of these issues the past two legislative sessions. But unfortunately, you have not corrected the inequities of House Bill 1047. The second concern, the taxpayers of the Carrington School District did not receive the same property tax relief as taxpayers of other districts, thus creating a second inequity. The taxpayers of Carrington received 59.69 property tax mill levy reduction, while other school districts' taxpayers across the state received 75 mils in property tax reduction. The past legislative sessions have understood the seriousness of inequity in school funding formulas. They have worked with these school districts to fix the issue. The inequities of House Bill 1047 need to be addressed. Thank you for your time. I'll take any questions that you may have.
You said that your neighbor school district is 185. Which school district is that?
Mid-Cota.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other interested persons?
Thank you, Chairman Hoag and members of the Taxation Committee. My name is Mitch Carlson, Superintendent at Lemoore Public School, and I also am here to address the section of House Bill 1047 that deals with the property tax relief dealing with schools. When first it came out, Senate Bill 2199 was put in and House Bill 1047 was put into legislation, this law restricted the ability of many schools, along with the Lemoore Public School, to operate the last 3 years, and what's more important is all future years at 2008 levels. The 185 mills that we previously had the authority to operate our school system has shrunk down to 168 mills with enactment of this legislation. Like 68 other schools similar to us in the state, this legislation now put education funding to these schools back to an equity issue on funding public schools from state sources. Each school is unique in its financial situation. With all schools receiving equitable funding, the local school board can then decide if those funds, extra funds that we are requesting, are needed to operate their school system or to give property tax relief to their local patrons. Because in the last 3 years, we have been at the maximum 110 mills, and that's going to be forever. Now, going from the school board, the school funding standpoint, I'm looking at the local taxpayer standpoint in our district. From the taxpayer's perspective in the town of Lemoore, the bill passed, the last two legislations were to deal with property tax relief. In the county of Lemoore, when considering all taxes together, from county to city to school, the city of Lemoore in 2008 had the highest property tax of any town in Lemoore County by 33 mills. They had the highest by 33 mills of any town in their county. Although residents of Lemoore had the highest tax levy in the county, they received the least amount of tax relief in the county. While neighboring towns received 75 mills reduced on their taxes, the residents of Lemoore received 58 mills reduced on their taxes. I do believe that the committee understands the issue at hand, but the question that has not been answered to me in these other school districts is, in this situation, is the following. Is the committee or the Education Taxation Committee, which was appointed, going to do anything about it? Possible solutions that we have talked about was all schools receiving 75 mills. Other solutions that were discussed was all schools receiving 65 mill levy reduction and then possibly going up to 120 mills. Another formula that devised last session was schools have not been levying over 100 mills in previous years. They would receive added mill levy reduction based on what was over the 100 mills if they were not receiving the full 75 mill reduction. This formula discussed in the last legislative session, I do believe, would have been a viable solution. I believe the solution would have worked until a section of the bill was stricken out that dealt with the hold harmless clause. We are currently on the third year of this funding formula, and the landscape and needs of our school district's law committee have changed since 2008. You know, and explaining to a new superintendent, if they come into our state or our district, explaining to them why they are funded lower than the preceding, than your other school districts, is tough to explain. And you have to explain to them, because you did not tax enough in 2008, that you are going to get less state funding. The crucial question that I have, and what I consider many districts out there are wondering, is this committee going to take action or leave the funding as is? I, along with my school board and many other school districts, would like to know what the answer to that question is, so an appropriate course of action can be put into place. I thank you for your time, and I would field any questions at this time.
Questions for Mr. Carlson? Representative Kelch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if the property tax relief fund wasn't there and you had 185 mills, you would get so much money. Now you're getting basically 110 mills plus the property tax relief. How much less money is that for your school than it would be if we didn't have the property tax relief?
Right now, based on this year's numbers, we are getting approximately $132,000 less this year than what we would have the capability of getting.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, senators, my name is Mark Weston. I'm superintendent of schools in Castleton, North Dakota. again, and you're probably going to hear this three or four times, but I guess I'm going to give it a little bit different slant just to give it perspective, I hope. For many of our districts, you know, we get asked by our representatives, you know, where are you at on your levy? Or if you're at 108, why are you here? You could be at 110. I think the real core issue here and the thing that needs to be addressed is the reality we have a district that generates roughly at $18 million valuation, about $18,000 per mill. And again, many of the districts that you're going to hear from have either reorganized or tried to remain as efficient as they could. Now, some of them maybe tried to do that, and I don't want to get argumentative with my neighboring districts that were at 185 mills. But in Castleton, we were 20 mills below that. And I've heard from our peers, superintendents, that went up to the 185 because in these committees they got wind of what was going to potentially happen, and why wouldn't they maximize and get the full 75 mills of state tax property relief. Others said, you know what, we don't need it, it's not the right thing to do. So the reality is you try and keep up with this runaway train, so to speak, when you watch the values go up and you wonder, how are we going to be able to maintain this? There's still that equity issue that we are faced with. If I'm 10 mils under the maximum, that's 180,000. We're actually 20 mils. I lose $360,000. There are other districts in this state that are getting that $360,000 sent to them from Bismarck. We are forced now to stay at 110 mils, and I see some of my peers that are levying 90 mils, 80 mils. If you get a wind farm or oil, you might be less than that. I'm not knocking them, but they're at that level because they're getting state aid from you folks, and you're saying you're never going to change it. And as you try and keep up, our formula allowance is at $3,910. That gets impacted by this. We know that. So now that stays down as well and gets compressed. That's the heart of the issue here. We know the intent. The intent was good. I'm not critical of that. But almost all legislation that gets passed has to be tweaked. It has to be recognized that this could be made better. It really isn't fair. Because you have many districts across the state right now. We're not getting that state aid. It's coming out of your coffers. You have limited resources. You've got tons of people that have ideas where it should go. I mean, honestly, and I'm not a proponent of Measure 2, but in one way, we'd like to see it out there because it forces you to rethink how you're going to fund education, because right now we don't like it. We don't think it's fair. I don't, again, I'm not promoting it, but can you understand that mindset? I mean, we're having to come up with 20 mils locally. It's going to force our citizens who were frugal, reorganized. You asked us to reorganize. Mr. Decker promoted that for years. Many districts have done it. They lowered down, became more efficient. Guess what? You're never going to get as much state aid as those others that didn't. So I hope you will recognize that and think about it and try and make some corrections.
Questions for Mr. Weston, Representative Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When two school districts combined in the middle of all this, what mill levy rate was used? You know, when you had two school districts that were combining, were the mills combined or did you use the higher one? How did that work?
Well, I might not be the right person. I was actually in Minnesota for 11 and a half years when this was going on and came back to the Castleton School District. They had reorganized with Chafee prior back in the mid-90s. And with that came efficiencies. In fact, we're talking with Mapleton right now, talking about efficiencies. It would be good for them for a variety of reasons. So I can't speak to that exactly how it was done, but I'm just talking about, I know the efficiencies that are gained through reorganization. Some of us realized that, got our mills down, or others were just frugal. They held firm. Maybe it was in teacher negotiations. Let's face it, salaries are 80% of our budgets. Whatever the teachers get, that's what the cooks, superintendents, and principals get. So if you're frugal and thrifty, are you being rewarded? And again, not that it was a reward system, but again, just asking that you would consider that as you move ahead with possible new language. But someone else might be able to answer that. I'm sorry. But.
Further questions for Mr. Weston? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Pat Feist from the Enderlin Area School District. We were one of those school districts that did reorganize prior to the change of the law. We voted the reorganization in 2007 and the law changed in 2008. So, and when we talk about substantial changes in mill levies, that certainly occurred in our district. The Sheldon School District was at 255 mills, operated a school plant with 23 students. We reorganized. Enderlin had a mill levy of 235. We, through the reorganization process and planning, the school boards decided to reduce that mill levy to 166 mils and provide a better education for our students. So that certainly was a decrease in mill levies. We were more efficient and we provided a better education for all of our students. In doing so, though, in effect, we were penalized for doing that. So our school district now receives, or are capped at 166 mils instead of 185. And so I again echo that we really appreciate if we could fix that and encourage people to be efficient. Encourage school districts to try to look at efficiency as well as providing best service that they can for their students. And that's the bottom line. We have to look at what we can do for our students. And we believe that we are providing an excellent education in Enderlin. And we did that by consolidating three other districts. We are now and that's why we're called Enderlin Area School. The Sheldon School became part of the Enderlin Area School, the Alice School did, and so did the Nome School over the 30-year period of time. So they looked at ways to become more efficient and provide a better education for area students.
Thank you, Mr. Feist. Any questions? Thanks.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you for allowing us this time today. I'm Steve Hall, Superintendent of Kindred Public Schools. Our district is located just south of Fargo and the West Fargo School Districts. Our district is made up of five communities. We have Davenport, Leonard, Walcott, Oxbow, and Kindred are the communities that represent our district. We currently have about 671 students K-12 in our system. Like other districts affected by mill levy loss, lost revenue, our board made the choice to keep our mills at 166.5 mills and not bump up to the maximum to take advantage of the potential 75 mills for property tax reduction. We felt it was only fair to remain at an operating level necessary for our district at the time. In hindsight, we should have bumped our mills up since no corrections or adjustments have been made to provide property tax reduction equity. Another reason we did not move our mills up was because we were in the planning and development stages for a new high school bond issue. In 2010, our district was fortunate to pass the referendum after two other failed votes. The property tax relief grant offered taxpayers of the Kindred School District tax relief of 66.5 mills, since we're at 166.5 mills. Our school bond issue to build a new school was approximately 62 mills. That sounded pretty good for our district. To have property tax drop by 66.5 mills and then build a new facility by adding back 62 mills. Well, this was a very positive opportunity created by the mill levy grant money for our district and maybe some other districts as well. And I am sure all districts and our patrons agreed, and we did pass our bond issue, I believe, due in part to this mill levy property tax reduction grant. It played a key role. By the way, after going through the building project, which we hope to be in the building this August as we build our new high school, I would say that one thing that I found through this process is that we tapped out our debt limit. And I do believe that 10% assessed value is too low if school districts are going to manage old buildings and upgrade facilities within the state. We are currently at 105 mills, but I believe that's only temporary. If it were not for the federal ARRA funds the past few years, there is no doubt that we would be at the max of 110 mills. Now that those grant dollars are gone, I'm sure we'll soon be there. There is one other major concern, maybe not a concern for any other district but our district, that is looming on the horizon for the Kindred School District. And that's getting closer each day, and that has to do with the Fargo-Moorhead Metro Flood Plan. The project for the diversion around the city of Fargo and Moorhead. We call it the Fargo Dam for the Kindred School District. You all approved money for the start of this project in the last session, probably the last two sessions, a little bit to help move that forward. This project will potentially impact 23% of our taxable valuation, almost one-fourth of our school district. As it stands right now, the flood project or dam would eliminate the city of Oxbow. Approximately 100 homes and 50 house development next door to that's known as the Bakke addition. Again, that is 23% of our valuation. This property loss could be a huge setback to the Kindred School District. I encourage you all to be educated on the full impacts of the diversion and the project costs throughout the state, or for the entire state. Now, if this project goes through, our remaining school district taxpayers would have to pick up the lost valuation due to the project. We will still have operating expenses and a new building to pay for, and less valuation and loss of students. We would still have over 500 students to educate if we lost every one of those students in that impacted area. We're still a large school district for a Class B North Dakota. If we lose 19% of those students, they're gone probably forever. How would the mill levy grant treat our district? How are we going to be affected if this mill levy grant is in place and we would lose taxable valuation? Do we fall into the exemptions that were just discussed and how we would handle that? I'm not exactly sure what the impacts are going to be because of the project and the mill levy grant dollars, if we read it correctly, for lost valuation, property changes, and so on. So I do believe that's a question that really is of a concern to our district as this flood plan project moves forward and the significant impact that it's going to have on our district. The long-term and maybe short-term effect of our district with the mill levy distribution has created inequity in funding between districts in the state. I do think adjustments need to be made to balance out the discrepancies that currently exist for districts not receiving the maximum relief. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Hall? Thank you. How many other members of the public do we have that would like to testify on this agenda item? Anyone else? Okay, thanks. Committee discussion on this. Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering if there was a superintendent here that went through the reorganization during that time frame and how they dealt with the differing mills they had, if those were combined. Is there anyone that could speak to that? Not before, but right during that process where their mill levies were counted.
Well, we can poll our witnesses to see if any of them would like to try to respond to that.
Representative Meyer.
Restate your name, please.
I'm Brian Dukscher, Superintendent of the Carrington School District, but I also sit on the State Board of Public Education. The State Board of Public Education hears the reorganization plans that you're asking about, and recently we haven't heard many reorganization plans.
But were there any during this critical time frame when you know, if they weren't levying up to 185 mills, or some were, if there were two that combined right during that time, and what, you know, how, what mill levy rate was determined with a combination is the question. I mean, you know, during 2008 when this was all coming about.
To my knowledge, I don't think we dealt with any examples like that you're giving. I think Cindy Labor at the Department of Public Instruction, she's our contact person there. I think she could probably do that research, but to my knowledge, I don't think we dealt with any specific examples like that.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I want to understand on page 2, line 23 through 26. In western North Dakota, we've got an oil boom going on, in case anybody didn't know it. We have some major construction going on there. Towns are growing 2 to 3 times their population in the year. So we've got a lot of valuation coming on for our school districts. And some parts of the other state, I think the growth is stagnant, values are stagnant. Unlike other states where they're going downhill, I think we're pretty stagnant. The question is, our school districts, when they do their mill levy and these new valuations, which are not getting tax exemptions, they're going up at full value, the schools for the 110 mills are going to be able to get the additional money for this new evaluation that's going on the record. But does this eliminate them from getting the gain for the 75 mills that they, because of the increased valuation that they would have got if we hadn't passed this law? And under this, are they restricted to the average growth percentage of the average growth across the state? They are.
I see Mr. Wallstedt is nodding yes. Is that
okay?
Respond to that? Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dovdahl, yes, that is the effect. Let's say there's a 50% valuation increase, the 110 mills would generate 50% more funds. However, the, let's say, 75 mills of relief would not be increased by 50%. It would be increased by whatever the statewide valuation increase would be, would, let's say, 10%. So that's how that restriction would apply.
Representative Hedlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John and committee, when I look at the cost to continue this program and the increase that, you know, has been added into this bill, I guess I would like to see, you know, if possible, what the effect of reducing the mill levy reduction from 75 mills to 65 mills, see how much reduction in cost that would cost to the state, and then allow the school districts maybe to increase the cap to 120, you know, giving them the ability to generate those funds locally. I think it may help solve some of the equity problems, and it also might reduce the cost of this program going forward, if possible.
Go ahead, sir.
Mike Severson, Superintendent of Salem Elmont School District. In Representative Meyer's comment regarding the consolidation, the New Salem Elmont District did go through a consolidation at that time. I was not the superintendent at the time, but I came into this. In 2007 and 8, New Salem had a general mill levy of 150 and Elmont had one of 115, but their total with the special assessments, building and sinking and interest was 172 and 182. As Elmont sent their kids to New Salem, they were able to drop their mill levy and put it on a tuition, so their mill levy dropped from 182 down to 135. New Salem raised theirs from 149 to 161, and then their total is 183. So when we went into this consolidation, the two districts combined, they wrote in the plan there would be a minimum mill levy of 160 mills. That would be the minimum. When this bill went through and they had the property tax reduction, the mill levy reduction grant, Jerry Coleman, who is the financial officer, called me and said that they would blend our mills, which they took the 161 that New Salem was levying and they used 135 that Elmont was using, and they blended it to 154.5. So we ended up actually dropping 5.5 mills from what the plan actually said, plus we lost, you know, whatever between that 160 and 150, 160 and 175. So over the 4 years, looking at, you know, 20 mills a year at $6.5 million tax evaluation, we were talking about $500,000 that we did not receive because, you know, we were the previous superintendent and the boards were, you know, they were conscious of the mill levy and kept it down and kept the expenses down. Therefore, we ended up not being able to reap the benefits that the other school districts are doing. So, you know, if you're looking at, you know, that $6.5 million, you're talking, like I said, $500,000, and that would cover our deficit. We got the first year with the stimulus, the first 2 years of the stimulus dollars, we still deficit spent the second year. This year we're looking at deficit spending again. Had we had that money, we would not be deficit spending, but we're working very hard to try to remedy that. But in In answer to your question, yes, we did. They blended our mills between the two districts, and we ended up lower than what we actually wanted, what we actually had in the plan. So.
Thank you.
Yes.
Questions for Mr. Severson? Thank you.
Thank you.
Further committee discussion on this agenda item? Comments? Senator Cook?
Mr. Chairman, I do have a question, and it's the same section that Representative Drubdahl spoke to. But before I do, just, you know, maybe part of the process here, we have six superintendents who have taken out of a very busy schedule to make a trip to Bismarck today to share their concerns with this committee. It was referenced that there is another committee, and that's the Education and Tax Joint Committee. And they also, I'm sure, will be dealing with this issue. Some of us serve on both, but for the most part, they're two different committees. And I'm sure these six individuals will again take out of their busy time and attend that committee hearing. The first comment is, I think that it would be wise to maybe get this issue into, for their sake, their time is valuable, to get this issue into one committee. The other comment is that we, I think, understand the challenges. We've heard it for some time now that they have out here and how they look at this. It's a tough issue. This was introduced as a property tax relief bill, not an educational funding bill. But despite that, it's created some challenges. And I don't know what the solution is. I think that's been the hardest part in trying to make everybody singing kumbaya together is finding the right solution. And maybe it's going back to the drawing board and starting all over again. But I just, I want to throw that out. I hope that somewhere, Mr. Chairman, you have a conversation maybe with the chairman of the other committee and for the consideration of all those who have an interest in this so that they can at least put their efforts all in one basket and not have to deal with two committees. My question, though, is regarding this cap that we have on how much of the grant might grow. If I remember right, in the spring at the session, or last spring, we were looking at a statewide average of around 7%. John, is that correct?
That sounds about right.
That 7% would have been the cap for the first year of this biennium then, correct? Do we know now what the cap is going to be for the second year of the biennium?
I don't.
We should, I think. I think we should know that by now. It should be the valuations that were, what should I say, certified back in probably October. But I think we should. I'd like to know what that statewide average in growth is now. And I'd like to know to what degree there is a estimated or projected growth for the first year of the next biennium, if we could find that out. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Cook. Regards your first comment, I think that's well taken. I will talk to the chairman of the Education Taxation Committee and figure out which committee is the most appropriate to deliberate on that during the rest of the interim. Because I agree, I don't think it makes sense for the interested parties, and in this case, the superintendents, to have to come to two committee hearings to provide input. Representative Kelsch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I was fairly involved in this in the last session, and Mr. Walstead and myself and other people had come up with several what we figured were viable solutions. Somehow got swept under the rug in the process. It was stated that this started out as a property tax relief measure, not an education funding measure, and I guess that I would accept that. At this point, when school districts are losing $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, because of the formula, it's an education issue, because somebody's suffering because of that. And this Lamar superintendent, 132, I think he said, that's two teachers' pay and benefits and all that at least. That's got to come from someplace. I don't know how their teachers' salaries are or anything like that, but Representative Meyer had talked about if they did reorganization in the middle of this, but what had happened in a lot of school districts is they had done a reorganization just before this bill, just before 208, and were able to cut their mill levies, as was mentioned, and they got caught in this, and they have no recourse to get that money back. And as we all know, the costs are going up every day. So I think it's imperative that there's a solution found for this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further committee discussion or questions or suggestions about the way forward? If not, we'll take our break now at 9:50 on the clock on the wall, and we'll come back at 10 o'clock. Well, it would probably be limited to natural person, non-resident natural persons. Any further questions? Representative Nathy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Terry, just real quick question. Wind farms, are they classified under commercial?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nathy, yeah, they're classified as commercial. Of course, their value is, their taxable value is quite a bit less, but yes, they're included in the commercial.
How about organizations such as Ducks Unlimited? Are they commercial or ag?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nathy, I don't know. I assumed that they were ag, but I don't know.
Thank you.
Further discussion on the Alabama property tax exemptions? Thank you, Mr. Traynor. Let's move on to the next agenda item, which is the presentation by Mr. Wallstead of a bill draft to incorporate a market value floor for agricultural property tax valuation formula.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, the bill draft, in this case, the number up on the top left corner, 13.0016. And it does what the chairman just described. The section of law affected here is the one that is used to determine by formula valuation agricultural property valuations, true and full values for property tax purposes. On page 2 of the draft, down at the bottom, underscored language is the only change that is being made by the bill, and what it says is the county-wide average values, and these are the ones that are certified by NDSU to the tax commissioner and then provided to the counties, for cropland and non-cropland for each county may not be less than blank percent of the market value of cropland and non-cropland for each county. Fairly simple. It just puts a floor on valuation, and at an unspecified percentage that would have to be determined after looking at available data. Now, I just following up on that, I talked with Marcy about data. She felt that the sales ratio study data on agricultural property values is not really suitable for use for this purpose. She said Dwight Acree might be a better source of information. So I talked to Dwight Acree at NDSU, who does all the number crunching through the formula. He said, "The probably most reliable information available currently on agricultural property valuation is collected through an annual survey of farmers and ranchers by NAS, National Agricultural Statistics Service." And I've distributed copies to you. And the right-hand column on these sheets shows average value, and that's dollars per acre for rented land from the survey data. Dr. Acri thought this information is pretty accurate on market values. However, all the farmers I know are pretty darn clever. And they know that when they fill out surveys, there might be a result from what they put down. And if this NAS information was started to be used as a basis for valuing land for property tax purposes, well, I guess you can predict what would happen to those estimates. Farmers don't do that?
I've got it.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you. How, with this, how are we talking production value or sale of the land to, when we're talking about the market value for cropland, non-cropland in each county? Well, you know, what we produce out there and what we get paid for it, and you know, the western part of the state, we are absolutely being overrun. I mean, land that maybe was valued at $200 an acre, maybe it's $5,000 a foot. How is all this, and I'm not exaggerating, north of Dickinson. So how does that plug into this? I don't see how we can even deal with that in the western part of the state.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Meyer, the current formula is based on productivity. It looks at production numbers, interest rates, all of those factors to come up with a productivity value. This would bring into play another valuation, a floor based on a percentage of market value, and that is that exploding number that you're seeing in the western part of the state. So,
just to follow up on that, so is there any way, like market value for cropland, can that be figured out if it's going to be a farming entity or a ranching entity, or if it's just being, you know, the escalating land prices we're seeing? That is never singled out, is it, on those assessments?
Well, that's another issue, I guess, that has to be determined. What does market value mean? Highest and best use, or use by a farmer for what he intends to do with it? Sarah's our expert on those issues. It can be tricky, right? Yeah. It's not a number that you can just look up in a book.
So basically, with this language, the percent of the market value for cropland is just the straight dollars of what it's bringing right now on a sale. So that's all that we'll be looking at, correct?
The market part, yeah.
Just the market value. Production isn't factored into it at all, other than how it's done currently. This is in addition to it, market sales.
Yeah. Two different kinds of value, and one is a percentage and the other not.
Senator Cook.
Mr. Chairman, two trends that have been going on with the taxable value of agriculture property since the production formula was put into place is, number one, the statewide average of the taxable value relative to market value has continually gone down over the years. The capitalization rate had something, or the cap had something to do with that, but I know it got down below 50%. And I think now probably it's coming back up. But the other thing that was even more obvious to me is the drastic disparity amongst counties. I thought I had the latest one here, but I got 2006, but it'll still show that disparity. I think you have a county here, Benson County, with a high of the relationship of the taxable value to market value at 78%. And it goes all the way down to, here's one at 33%, 33.6 in Grant County. And these numbers change, but the first question that raised in my mind is, why do we have such a disparity? And I assume it's got to do something with the actual demand or the competition to buy the land for whatever, hunting purposes, ag purposes, whatever. And that's why, you know, I was looking at a floor so that somewhere this disparity would go away. The way if I can ask Mr. Walster the question here, the way you have this written, it would apply county by county. Is that correct?
Correct.
My first question is, would it be easier and wiser to do it on a parcel basis? And I ask that question because even again this fall, hunting, farmer, landowner, also county commissioner, upset with the amount of farmland that gets purchased by out of state for recreational purposes. And he challenges me every year when I'm down there to somehow find a way of identifying recreational ag land. And we have had attempts to do that in the legislature in the past, and it's always been extremely difficult to come up with a black line between when is ag land and when is it recreational. But if you had land that, for example, sold considerably above what the formula base the value at, you know, two times whatever, then you could probably identify that as a different class of property and set a floor there. That's just one thought, but I understand the challenges, which could also, make these analysis inaccurate, but the challenges of getting accurate market value prices on ag land. And I look at this chart and I just look at Lemoore County, land that I know of down there is renting for four times more than what they have here as the average rental rate. And it's not unique land. So I don't put a lot of value in what they're saying here with this report.
Okay. Yeah, I think the challenge of this proposed bill will be to figure out what's a fair number for that market value, because without a accurate definition of that, it's hard to get a fair floor on ag valuations.
Chairman.
Senator Cook.
I may just follow up. And again, I think we need to, before we even go down this road, we need to get some much more current and accurate information. We've got to see as far as what Marcy can present to us that's going on there now. I know that there's things happening with ag land because of the low interest rates. This whole thing might be adjusting itself right now on its own. If we can just, reach out to the tax commissioner's office and see what current information they have now as far as what are the conditions and what are the challenges of the production formula. We need a production formula, but we've got to make sure it's one that's fair and that it works for everybody. And but again, I think that with what's going on out there right now with the taxes this year, this thing might be adjusting, and we should realize that.
Thank you. John, did we cover the 1045 agenda item as far as market value statistics, or do you have separate information to present on that?
Oh, well, that was the information I was discussing about the NAS info. And
all right. Then let's go to the 11 o'clock agenda item, which is John's presentation of a bill draft to provide for informational reports by building authorities on bond issues to finance buildings in connection with an agreement between political subdivisions.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, the bill draft here up in the left corner, 13.0015, and the bill draft was requested to set up a central filing source for information on building authority borrowing and property ownership and agreements for use by a school or other political subdivision. And so that's what the draft would do. Now it says initially, upon the issuance of bonds, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and in retrospect, I'm thinking maybe it should say before the issuance of bonds. Maybe that information should be required to be filed with the Securities Commissioner before the Commissioner issues her order approving the sale of the securities. So just an issue for consideration. Anyway, a report is required to be filed. It goes to the Securities Commissioner, and then the bill draft lists the kind of information that that report has to have, and at the bottom provides that the Commissioner shall compile and maintain a summary of information on outstanding bond issues subject to this kind of reporting. Now, this relates only to those building authority kind of entities. And I know there has been discussion about maybe a broader kind of central source for information on indebtedness of political subdivisions. But this draft, as I said, is limited, doesn't cover all kinds of debt, covers only building authorities or other entities acting like a building authority acts. Oh, one other thing. On the second page there, line 10 about application, this applies to bond issues before August 1, 2013 if bonds haven't been retired and they're still outstanding as of that date and so on. But the way I wrote that, it only applies to those bonds issued before the effective date. So on line 10 there, where it says Section 1 of this Act applies to, I would add, any bond issue occurring after July 31, 2013, and then take care of those bonds issued before that date. So anyway, if it comes around again, I'll fix that.
Any questions or comments on this item? Senator Cook?
Well, I'd like to see it include all bonds that are issued. I thought it did as I read it. When I read building authority or other entity issuing bonds, I thought other entity was housing authority?
Only
airport authority?
Well, only if they are issuing bonds in connection with agreement for use of a building by a political subdivision. So it wouldn't cover all bonds. Probably would cover housing authority.
How about
a housing authority is a political subdivision.
Yep.
How about the university system? The institutions that issue bonds to finance buildings.
I don't think that would be included because it's not a political subdivision using the building. So anyway, if the idea is to expand it to get a snapshot of all the debt that's outstanding, the language would have to be broadened. So just so I understand, what we would like to incorporate is any debt of a political subdivision or any debt of a building authority or somebody else who's putting up a building kind of in place of the political subdivision doing the funding itself.
Senator Cook?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the question is, should any citizen of North Dakota be able to go to one central location and find out the amount of bonded debt that he's got some liability for simply because he owns a piece of property? And today, you can't do that, is my mind, so I would argue that we should have a central depository for all bonded debt, where anybody who wants to see, you know, how much debt that piece of property obligates the individual to be liable for, you got to be able to find the number. And so I would think we should include everything.
Okay. And not just general obligation, special assessments as well?
Well, yeah. But it should be broke. I mean, a person should be able to find out what is general obligation, what is revenue bonds, what is, and that's not hard to do.
Further comments or question on this bill draft?
Mr. Chairman, I agree with Senator Cook, but I think you really need to separate it in the report, you know, the general obligation, the revenue, the spec, because there's different liabilities involved with all the different bonds, so sure. It can't be just one number. It really needs to be broke out what all the different obligations and how they apply, because, which we had a report in another committee with a special assessment, there isn't as much liability, so I think it's a good idea, but to make sure they're all broke out and showed individually.
That's a good point. Further discussion on this? If not, we'll just go on to the next item. Presentation by Legislative Council about special assessment indebtedness, political subdivision liability, and the special fund doctrine, and a recent opinion by our Attorney General.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, me again. The memo, I think all of you have a copy of. The question that was raised is, why don't the debt limitations in our Constitution apply to special assessment debt if, and it's not an if, when, state law requires that if a special assessment district revenue is insufficient, the property tax levy of the political subdivision is the fallback. So it's standing behind that bond issue. So why don't we consider this a debt? The answer is, in a series of court decisions, and it looks like North Dakota might have been the first state to even recognize this thing, but when there is a situation like this where the first obligation is against the properties benefited, and it is only a situation where the property tax levy power of the district only comes into play if that first line of payment fails, the court, North Dakota, said that is not a debt of the political subdivision. It is only a contingent future liability, and as such, not a debt, doesn't count against the debt limit. However, I guess the next question that comes up is, okay, so what happens when that does occur and the first line of payment fails? Now it's a debt, isn't it? Yes, it is a debt. But the advice I got from a local bond attorney, whose opinion I greatly respect, is that the entire outstanding amount at that time would still not be a debt. It would only be 1 year's worth of payments that would be a debt of that political subdivision. Anyway, shortly after I put this opinion together, the Attorney General issued an opinion, which remarkably enough, had a lot of the same issues, and even more remarkably, came to the same conclusions that I did. So I thought, well, I'm going to copy this and give it to the committee, just to show that sometimes I do agree with the Attorney General. Basically saying we've got this contingent future liability issue that takes it out of the debt provisions, but if you look at the last paragraph, a city should be aware of the potential financial liability it may face. Even though it's only a contingent obligation, it could become a direct obligation years down the road if the housing authority becomes unable to make full payments and draws on the city's pledge. That would require measurement of the funds under the applicable debt limits and payment by the city. So, anyway, I guess there's pretty solid law on the books that courts have said contingent future liability, not debt, and that's why those things are not measured against that 5% debt limit that we have in our Constitution.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question that comes to mind to me then is, when I apply for financing with a bank, should I not be including my contingent future liabilities in my debts?
Absolutely not. That doesn't ripen into anything until it actually lands on you, I guess.
It doesn't count until you default, okay? Okay, I think that's just an informational piece of agenda item, and so we'll keep rolling along with the 1120 item, presentation by John, on the issue of using special assessments as a replacement for property tax revenues.
Well, Mr. Chairman, committee members, once again, this is just informational, but in the discussions on Measure 2 and some other discussions, it has been suggested by some that if there was no property tax, political subdivisions could use special assessments to replace property tax revenues. So the question was, well, is that true? And the answer is no, absolutely not. The first problem is not all political subdivisions can even levy special assessments. Even under home rule authority, only counties and cities have access to home rule authority that would allow more creativity. And in addition, I made a copy of the statutory provision, and this is a section listing what expenses municipalities can defray through special assessments. And none of the normal, what we consider the day-to-day operating costs of local government are on the list. It's infrastructure stuff. Water supply, street system, street lighting, even Christmas street lighting you can special assess for, planting trees, grass along boulevards, flood protection, parking lots, ramps, garages, and so on, and that's it. So special assessments could not replace absent property tax revenues. And even if they could, there would be an enormous shift in who pays for what, because assessments have to be assessed not on the basis of your property's value, but the benefit your property receives from whatever it is you're paying for. And so there's a whole different structure. So anyway, once again, like I said, that was a question that came up. There's the information, and the answer as I see it, it couldn't happen.
So if I understand what you're saying, John, if let's say, suppose Measure 2 passes, the cities and the political subdivisions will not have the ability to use special assessments for lost property tax revenue. That's off the table.
That's off the table under existing law. I suppose the legislature could look at statutory changes to completely restructure what special assessments are, but like I said, it would greatly shift who pays for what.
Does that also mean, and I haven't studied Measure 2, but does Measure 2, would that eliminate existing special assessments?
No. Specials would continue because they're not based on assessed value, and that's what the measure prohibits.
Okay. Representative Belter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, I think that in a number of municipalities where you have special assessments, they may not necessarily be special assessing for the entire cost of a project, and maybe, you know, for example, maybe 50% of a project is covered by general property tax. So in those instances, then the municipality could come back in and do 100% assessment for improvements that they maybe now are covering partially with the property tax.
That, yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Belcher, that would be an option for those cities to consider. Now, the other possibility is it might be the state's responsibility to replace that part that the city is currently paying from general property tax. But there are many, many unanswered questions with Measure 2's effects.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, John, then in that case, that would be one of the major problems with Measure 2, because I think you would find that there could be a tremendous difference between the policies of different municipalities, and subsequently, if it was determined that the state should go in and pick up that share for improvements that is now covered in property tax, could be a large benefit to one municipality and to the disadvantage of the other one.
Absolutely. And I know from reading papers that different cities have responded differently to how much to rely on specials or property taxes.
Further comments? Senator Cook.
Mr. Chairman, John, do townships, this says here power of municipalities, do townships and counties have the same authority to special assess for these types of services?
Townships and?
Counties.
Counties? Townships, no. Townships have limited special assessment authority. That's a special chapter. Counties, somewhat. Rural subdivisions, counties can do special assessment projects for infrastructures. Right, Terry? Yeah. So the counties do have some authority for specials, yeah.
City fixes the road in front of my place, they special assess it. There's no special assessing in counties or townships for any type of road repair? I mean,
I would guess that in a rural subdivision, they would treat you the same with the road in front of your place. But on the county road, no, probably not a special assessment, probably a general tax.
But if property, do they have the authority? Can they do it if they want to? That's my question. What is the special assessment authority for a county or a township? I see it what it is now for a municipality. It doesn't include fire. It doesn't include police protection, but there's a lot of other things. Thank you, Senator Hogue. He's going right to code.
Well, there's a memo that I gave the committee at the last meeting that goes through specials, and it lays out what the townships can do and what the cities can do and what the counties can do. I didn't bring the darn thing with me.
Well, we can get it again, but I read the memo, and I don't remember what it says.
Well, I'm looking. Let's go on.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask a question of
Senator Dotson-Rod.
Of Mr. Walsted? This is sort of in the same category as special assessments, but I'm thinking of agricultural land. There are some parts of the property tax that's currently being assessed or being levied on property that would not go away if measure number two should pass. In the county I live in, Richland County, we have drain taxes. And those, they're probably 35 or 45 somewhere in there, legal drains in the county. The legislature has provided the authority for the water management district to levy up to $2 an acre for maintenance on those per year. So virtually with all the flooding that's gone on in the last number of years, virtually every drain in the county has a $2 per acre fee. So most farmers in the county, when they open their property tax statement, will see $320 on that quarter per year to maintain the drain. That will not go away. If measure number two should pass, that will stay, as I understand it. That will stay on the statement.
Okay, my interpretation.
So could the legislature along that line then say that, well, if measure number two passed, we'll provide similar authority to that, to set up a, if the townships want to do some work on their roads and they can't use the assessed value approach, they could levy up to a maximum as provided by the legislature of $2 an acre that could be used for roads. That would be an option available to the legislature in response to the passage. Or they could set up a menu of charges and fees that could be used for a number of different things. It would be a shift, it would be unfair, because the worst piece of property in the county would pay the same rate as the best piece of property in the county, because you couldn't use assessed value. It'd be a per acre fee. So it would be horribly unfair in our way of thinking today. But it would be an option that the legislature would have available. And I can see how it could work in a rural environment, in a township, to take care of roads or other things. But I don't know in the city if there'd be a similar option available to the legislature to set up I think it'd be very difficult. I think there'd be lawsuits over it if we did do it, because I think there'd be a lot of questions about different quality and values of property, some that are vacant lots and some that are in some ways even today going back to the city for taxes, that it would be difficult to, I think difficult to make it work. But I think it's one of those things that it's in the realm of possibility as a response.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dotson-Rod, I agree with everything you said. Those are all options that could be considered. And I particularly agree with the part you said about lots of lawsuits.
That's a bad thing?
No, I didn't say it was a bad thing.
Okay. Just asked. In answer to Senator Cook's questions, counties do have special assessment authority. They can do it under 1128.1 for police protection, garbage removal, defraying the expenses of recreation service districts as well. So 1128.1 and 2. For those limited purposes, counties may create, I don't see it. Okay, we'll go on to the next agenda item, which is talking about how taxpayers in other states are able to protest special assessments against their properties.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, at the last meeting, the suggestion was made to get information on how special assessments can be protested in other states. And I thought, well, there must be a nice table somewhere that somebody put together. So I started looking. I couldn't find anything. Called in our librarian, who's an expert. She couldn't find anything. Called NCSL. And they haven't ever done anything like that. They couldn't find anything like that. They contacted every organization they could think of. Nobody's ever done that. So I gave up on that, and I started just taking a look at laws in other states, and it soon dawned on me why nobody's ever done that. Just of the few states that are reported here, none of them match. Everybody's unique. Every state has a different method, and in some states, they have different methods depending what kind of project it is that's being undertaken. So, anyway, what I tried to do was get information just from some states that we would consider our region of the country to compare. In North Dakota, a protest for a project bars the proceeding if it has the names of owners of a majority of the area of property in the improvement district. In Minnesota, there isn't anything like that, really. The city council can approve a project with a simple majority vote if it has been petitioned by 35% or the owners of at least 35% of the street frontage. If they haven't, then they have to have an 80% majority vote to approve a project, and aggrieved property owners can appeal to the district court, and that district court appeal is the exclusive remedy. That's it. Only shot. In Montana, they have, and I've underscored the language here because it's, first of all, they can halt a project for 6 months. They don't halt it for good. It's just a six-month delay if it is signed by owners of 50% or more of total projected assessments on the property, or owners of property that will be subject to 50% or more of assessments for the proposed work. I don't understand the difference between the two things there. Projected assessments or cost of the work, to me, there isn't really any difference. And then if it's a street maintenance project, it is completely barred, and it's not limited to 6 months, if protests are received from 50% or more of property owners, 50% or more, or owners of 50% or more of the taxable valuation of property, or owners of property subject to 50% or more of the projected assessments. So there are three different measurements there, all of which are different from the measurement we use, which is majority of area. South Dakota really isn't any opportunity. You can show up at the meeting of the city governing body and scream and yell. That's it. That's all you get. Nebraska, kind of the same thing, except you get two opportunities to show up and scream and yell. One is about the project, and then after that's been approved, you get to come and scream and yell about your individual assessment. Missouri, 50% or more of owners of property liable for the assessment. Now you see, the way the words are arranged, here in Missouri it's 50% or more of the owners of property liable, okay? So that's not 50% of the total cost. It's just the number of owners measures the 50%. In Colorado, if the city doesn't pay at least 50% of the special assessment through its own property taxes, then protests are allowed. If received from owners of a majority of all property benefited and constituting the basis of the assessment, okay? Majority of all property, owners of a majority of all property. is that by parcels or by area or the way that's worded, I would imagine there were a number of lawsuits and we'd have to go read them to find out what that really means. Wisconsin, they have a public hearing, you can scream and yell, but then you can also afterwards appeal to the circuit court. Now in Iowa, I thought they had a kind of an interesting approach. It takes a 3/4 vote to approve the project. And the city has allowed the option of seeking confirmation of its project by a court decree. When they do that, each owner of property is named as a defendant in the action, and the court issues a court order saying these are the assessments. And the real beauty of it, the court action gets added to the special assessments that go against the property when it's all over. So, anyway, I guess what committee members were looking for was some sense of what is the most standard method for protests, and I guess my answer is, I don't know. Every state seems to have come up with its own method of allowing protests to match whatever fairness dictated in their minds.
Questions or comments about selected protest techniques? If not, we will move on to what I think is the last agenda item before lunch, and that is a presentation by a member of the North Dakota League of Cities relative to the financial commitments that the cities require for developers.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Jelmstead. I'm here on behalf of the North Dakota League of Cities. Mr. Wallstead had asked us to check with a few cities to see what their developer requirements were for new developments within the city, as far as the upfront costs. So we did survey cities, did an email survey, asked them two questions. Does your city require the developer to pay upfront costs for new development infrastructure? And number two, if yes, at what amount? And as was discussed earlier, we got the whole range of responses from cities as to what their requirements are for developers, from upfront costs to from 100% by the developer to 100% of the project being special assessed by the city. The first category, I tried to break the answers down in the summaries that we got back from the cities into different categories. First category is yes, they require the upfront costs of 100% by the developer. Those were the cities of Lincoln and Williston. The next category was 50% by the developer. Those were the cities of Dickinson, Fargo, Grand Forks, and West Fargo, although they all had a little different approach as to how they went about that. In Dickinson, the city involvement is capped at 50% or $300,000, whichever is less, for a residential development, and 50% or $600,000 for a commercial or industrial development. And then the city's portion of that, of up to $300,000 or $600,000, would be special assessed. In Fargo, the developer is required to provide a letter of credit equal to 50% of the engineer's estimate of assessed costs, and that letter of credit stays in place until the special assessments are paid. In Grand Forks, the developer is responsible for 50% of the cost, with the remaining to be special assessed. And in West Fargo, developers are required to put up a promissory note for 50% of the cost, and that promissory note is released after the development is 75% filled. Then we had a few cities that provided that the developer would pay some portion of the upfront costs. Those would be Bismarck, Hazen, Jamestown, Mandan, and Minot.
In Bismarck, the developer pays 100% for grading, water, sewer, curb and gutter, and 40% for commercial and industrial streets. The city special assesses residential streets, and there is also a deposit option for curb and gutter with cost assessed and deposit released when the lots are sold or built upon. In Hazen, the city requires a 30% deposit from the developer for projects which is held in case of a default on of the special assessment payments. If the developer puts in water and sewer, the city will waive the deposit for streets and put them on special assessments. Jamestown, Mandan, and Minot all have very similar requirements. The developer pays for water and sewer, and special assessments are levied for streets, curb, and gutter. And we did have a few cities that provide for upfront costs being all covered by special assessments, those being Devil's Lake, Stanley, Valley City, and Wapton. In Devil's Lake, the city has been paying 25% of the infrastructure costs as an incentive, and special assessing the remaining 75%. In Stanley, and the most recent development on the north side of town, 100% of the infrastructure costs were special assessed. In Valley City, the last new development in 2005, the city paid the upfront costs with the agreement that special assessments would be collected as lots sold. And in Wapton, they have three options, more of an incentive. Some don't have to provide incentive for development, so that's why you have the variation. It's all local option.
And I guess that's what kind of prompted my question. I see Wilson pays 100% for the developer. They're building like crazy up there. Why is the city paying for it?
Thank you.
Committee will come back to order again, and we see that Mr. Vosburgh is in the room and is wanting to approach the podium and impart useful information, so we'll turn it over to him.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Miles Vosburgh with the Tax Commissioner's Office, and at the last meeting, a couple of requests for information came up that okay, there we go. The first item that came up during the last meeting, we provided some information that talked about the per capita sales tax revenue, local tax revenue that was generated by each city that imposes a local tax. And during that discussion, a question came up as to whether we could provide similar information for the state tax. And what I've handed out here is that information. It's based on 2010 taxable sales and purchases. It includes the 200 largest cities in North Dakota. And I need to point out that there are some differences between this data and the local tax revenue. The first is we don't track the actual tax collections on the state basis by city. We track the taxable sales and purchases. And so we took our taxable sales and purchases numbers and multiplied it times the 5% tax, which is going to be a close approximation. As you all know, we have 3% tax for farm machinery. We have 7% tax for alcoholic beverages, and then everything else, the 5%. So this is going to be close, but it's a rough approximation. The other difference is local tax collections is tracked and reported by where the sale takes place, and or where the goods are delivered. And so you can have a business in Fargo that is selling a product and deliver it to Bismarck. So for local taxes, that's going to be subject to Bismarck tax, and the Bismarck tax is going to be recorded and then remitted to the correct city. On the state tax purposes, for state tax purposes, the way we track the taxable sales and purchases is based on the location of the business. So in my example, those sales are going to be reported under Fargo, even though the local tax is collected and remitted to Bismarck, because that's where the ultimate delivery of the product is. And so I just want to point out, we're kind of comparing apples and oranges here when you're comparing the per capita tax figures for local tax versus the per capita tax for state tax purposes. On the last page, Kathy Strombeck put this together from our office, and you know, she noted the minimum amount from any city is Starkweather at $9, and the maximum is Lignite at $15,491. So, you know, I don't know how much you can glean from this, because, you know, you can have large sales delivered to small cities and so on and so, but for what it's worth, here is the information for your review. If there's anything further that we can do with this information, we can do that. Or if you have questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
Any questions for Mr. Vosburgh? If not, thank you.
Okay, the second item in the sales tax area that I was going to cover under the agenda item is there was a request for information about how other states treated Montana and Canadian sales, and if there's anyone out there like North Dakota, because we have the refund for the Canadian residents that make purchases here, and we have a point of sale exemption for the Montana residents when they come here to make a purchase and take the goods back outside of the state. We looked at all of the border states and all of the states surrounding Montana, and we found the only state that has any kind of an exemption out there is the state of Washington. And the state of Washington has in their sales tax code an exemption for purchases made by a non-resident where the goods are taken outside of the state, and the state of residence imposes a tax of less than 3%, and they ignore any local taxes. They just look at the state taxes. And so I think the only state that does impose a tax that impose a rate less than 3% is Colorado. Colorado has a 2.9% tax. And so we have Alaska, Delaware, Montana, Oregon, and New Hampshire that don't impose any tax. So if you have a resident from any one of those states, they go to Washington and make a purchase, it's for goods they're going to use outside of the state of Washington, they can provide documentation of their state of residency, sign an exemption certificate, and that purchase is exempt from tax. That is the only thing out there that we could find on all the bordering states of Canada or those states surrounding Montana.
So that provision in Washington would not allow a Canadian resident to benefit.
I'm sorry, John, I missed that. It applies to Canadian provinces also. So
rate is well over 3%.
In most cases, I believe that's right. I've got a document here that I printed off of the Washington's website, and according to them, it includes Alberta, Northwest Territories, Yukon Territory. So apparently some of the provinces do have a rate less than 3%. And I know there was also a question at one point in time. Some of the Canadian provinces have a tax that's more like a value-added tax than it is a sales tax. And The value-added tax is not considered here. It has to be a sales tax type tax that they the Providence has imposed. And if there's any questions on that, I'd...
Questions? Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Miles, could you provide us with a detailed list of the Montana exemptions by county? I think you have that available, or by city, whichever way.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drubdahl, we don't have that information at all. When a Montana resident makes a purchase, they need to sign a certificate here with their address on it. We don't even get that information unless we go audit that taxpayer and ask them to document the sales that they've exempted because there's a Montana resident making a purchase. So we don't have that information in our office.
Mr. Chairman and Miles, but when they report, when the local business reports their sales, they list on their Montana exemptions.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drubdahl, they no longer do. At one time that was true. We just ask for non-taxable sales and without any further delineation of why they're not subject to tax.
Thank you.
Further questions for Mr. Vosburgh, Senator Cook?
Just so I understand this correctly now, Mr. Chairman, Miles, the only two states in the union that exempt exempt Canadian residents is Washington and North Dakota.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cook, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? If not, thank you, Mr. Vosburgh. Committee 115 agenda item is set aside for the committee to have a discussion about further direction regarding the study of the sales tax exemptions, the health clinic sales tax treatment, corporate income tax issues, and individual and corporate income tax credits. Is there any discussion on that? Any requests for bill drafts? Any direction the committee would like to go? Senator Cook?
Mr. Chairman, Washington doesn't have a whole lot of opportunities to be number one at anything, and I just think we ought to let them be the only state that exempts Canadian. But I would certainly welcome a bill draft so that we can have some discussion and hear what possible objections to changing that policy might be. I wouldn't be afraid of it. And I wouldn't, you could throw Montana in there too if you wanted, but I'm sure Representative Drubdahl would have something to say.
Well, I think that's a suggestion for a bill draft, and I think that would be a good idea. The draft would eliminate the exemption for Montana residents or Canadian nationals who buy goods in North Dakota from being able to collect a refund on the goods that they buy.
Maybe it could be two bill drafts, two separate issues.
Mr. Chairman, do we have an idea of, and if Mr. Vosburgh said this, I apologize, but do we have a ballpark figure on the amount of Canadian and Montana, just a ballpark of exemptions, what the fiscal note on this would be?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Meyer, I think we have some estimates in our red book that I could get for you, and I could even get them today. I don't have them with me, but I think we have made some projections there.
Is there any way to project, of all the sales, how many of them actually claim the refund?
Mr. Chairman, that we would have no way of measuring that. We do also have actual numbers of refunds issued on the Canadian refunds. That would be available.
Okay. Thank you. So we're going to request a bill draft to eliminate those exemptions for non-residents. Any other?
Two drafts,
yeah. Okay. Any other discussion? If not, we'll move right on to the 1:30 agenda item, which is a bill draft to eliminate the stripper well status for new wells that are completed in the Bakken or Three Forks formation.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, bill draft has been distributed up in the left corner. It's 13.0021. It's a short bill, and it amends a short subsection of law that has a significant effect. It is part of the extraction tax law, and under that tax, there is an exemption for, and on line 7, the non-underscored language, the activity of extracting from the earth any oil from a stripper well property. Okay, now, a stripper well property is not a individual well. Maybe that's all there is one well, but if there is a stripper well on the property, the entire thing is eligible for this exemption, which means if I, as an oil company, have a well that is pumping 10 barrels a day, that's a stripper well property. I'm not paying extraction tax on that well's production. If I go drill a new well on that property, the new well is a stripper well exempt from extraction tax, even though I might be now pumping 2,000 barrels a day out of that new well. So this exemption is amended in the bill draft to provide that a well spud, and I still want to say spudded, but that's not right. It's spud, that's past tense, present tense, future tense. Apparently it's everything when you're spudding. A well spud on a stripper well property drilled and completed in the Bakken or Three Forks formation after, there's a blank there because we got to decide what that date should be, is not exempt until production from that well individually meets the requirements of the definition for stripper well status. And the numbers of barrels per day for stripper well status depend on the depth of the well. It's, I think it's 10, 20, and 30 barrels a day at different depths. And the effective date left blank also, because that would have to be decided when this should begin to apply. Now, the part about Bakken or Three Forks, I'm sure you all recall Mr. Helm's testimony at the previous committee meeting that to look into infill drilling in Bakken and Three Forks areas would be appropriate because new wells that would be quite profitable can be drilled on those after the existing wells have declined in production. But Madison and Lodgepole and other formations would not be included. So this would not apply to infill drilling on those other formations where exploration is somewhat more risky. Well, considerably more risky than the Bakken and Three Forks plays. So that's the bill draft, and I can address any questions.
John, in the last session, I think Representative Carlson had a bill draft towards the end of the session that would have dealt with taxation of stripper wells and non-stripper wells. Is this similar to his proposal, or is this something that's we've not seen?
Mr. Chairman, this is one part of his proposal, and it is essentially identical to one part of his proposal. His proposal to eliminate the stripper exemption for infill drilling was not limited to Bakken or Three Forks. It would have applied to any drilling activity on stripper property in the state. So it is different in that respect. This is also different from his proposal in a very significant respect, which is his proposal would have ratcheted down the oil extraction tax rate by a half of a percentage point at each of several barrels of oil per day statewide production markers. And I can't give you those numbers right now, but as production statewide barrels per day went up, the oil extraction tax would drop by a half a point at each of several markers. That part's not here.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman and John, I'm trying to recall, and maybe you could help me a little on when we set this up, this provision of the law that set out stripper wells separately, and we provided this a tax reduction on those stripper wells. I'm not sure when we did that, but we did that because we felt that they were having to invest and they weren't going to get much out of it. And it was kind of an incentive to have them go in, as I recall. And then at that somewhere in there, we made that distinction between the stripper well and stripper well property. And I'm trying to remember, why did we do that? Why would the legislature make a distinction between a stripper well, which would get this exemption, and what is in the law, which is stripper well property, which allows, you know, quite a bit of area? I'm not sure why we did that. Do you know what the reasoning was?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dotsenrod, actually, that's before my time, which means that's a long time ago. The stripper well exemption has been there pretty much since the extraction tax has been there. Now, my understanding from reading testimony and discussion was it was not so much to encourage new drilling in those areas, but just to encourage keeping those wells operating. If they're only producing 10 barrels a day or whatever, to keep them pumping rather than just shut them in. But, well, Mr. Ness is here, and he's way older than me, so maybe he remembers farther back. Oh, well, Lynn's here, too, so somebody probably has a good answer.
Come on up.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Lynn Helms, Department of Mineral Resources. I can't answer the question. I was working in the oil industry at the time that the stripper well tax exemptions were put in place, I hate to report, but it was originally built into the federal windfall profits tax, which was put into effect, I believe, in about 1978. And so it carried over into the North Dakota oil extraction tax, which was came into play at about the same time. The stripper well exemption was intended to encourage an oil or gas company to keep producing a marginal well for a long period of time, because it kept people employed, it kept domestic production in play, it paid gross production tax and all of that. So the incentive was put there to keep a marginal well producing for an extended period of time. The stripper well property was put in place in the event that somehow mechanically that well could no longer produce, you could replace it on its spacing unit or its lease with a replacement well, and it too would get the exemption. So that was the original intent of stripper well property, was that if you had a stripper well out there and you were willing to take the risk of drilling a replacement well or maybe an additional well on that property, you would get the exemption. But it came in with the windfall profits tax, which went away a long time ago too.
Further questions for Mr. Helms or John or Mr. Ness? Senator Cook?
No, just two things, Mr. Chairman. First off, I think all those conditions that motivated former policymakers to put this in place, to agree, still exist today. Secondly, and maybe a more important thing, is I believe timing is everything in public policy, and I can't help but think maybe timing for this discussion would be better after June than it is now.
Timing is important in a lot of matters. Any further questions? Comments? Representative Myers.
Could I ask Mr. Helm another question? I was wondering on the new unitization of the Bakken up at the Little Missouri State Park, that new unit. Is there anything in that permit that you issued on this unitized field if, like, you know, we all know the 18-month curve on the Bakken, you know, no matter what the technology is, the curve just keeps going like that. On this new unitized field, if one well, is there any provision in the permit that prevents them from handling one well for 18 months and then having the rest of the wells in that unit be stripper well properties?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Meyer, there is nothing in the Industrial Commission order that would prevent that from taking place. I want to think about, they would have to drop the average well production below 30 barrels per day per well for a period of 12 months, but doing so, they could qualify that unit as a stripper well property.
Do you know, I didn't read the permit, but how many are projected to be in that unitized field? How many wells are they projecting?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Meyer, there are currently 12 wells in there, and the ultimate development plan calls for 85 wells.
Okay. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Further questions for Mr. Helms? Thank you, Lynn. Further direction from the committee to John about study areas for the oil extraction tax or bill proposals. Representative Hattelstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With modern technology, we don't know if there's another zone that might show up in the future. And not saying that I support the idea, but if we were to suddenly decide and this bill passed, then we'd have to go back and revisit. So I think I would favor the elimination of the terms Bakken and Three Forks and just say that any well drilled in any formation.
Any further committee discussion on the extraction tax? Representative Striley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I'd like to see something similar to the Carlson bill myself, but I don't know what the support is of the other committee members.
Well, the Carlson bill was introduced. It might be worthwhile for the committee to study it, because one of the issues with the bill, aside from its merits, was that it was introduced at the last minute towards the very end of the session, and it was a lengthy bill with a lot of new concepts that was going to obviously impact a large segment of the state's revenue. So I think there was a lot of apprehension about it, simply because, you know, we're dealing with a big revenue item pretty late in the game. So I'm not opposed to bringing that back and taking a look at it. And I'd like some input from the rest of the committee, if they'd like to or not. Anybody else?
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't mind looking at that bill again.
Okay. Well, I don't think it can hurt to bring it back and look at it. We could put that on an agenda and bring it back as an agenda item. Any further discussion on the oil extraction tax? Senator Cook?
Well, Mr. Chairman, again, I think it's very important. I mean, it's everything, and I think we need to keep that in mind. But more importantly than that, we're sitting here in North Dakota, I think, with some great opportunities in front of us, just to do some great things. And I think there's some changes we got to make, but we can be in control of where we want to take this state to be. And I can't help but think we're getting the cart ahead of the horse here. I think it's important that we really stand and have some good discussions about long-term planning, where we want to take this state, what we can do, and then ultimately tax policy will fall into place. And I understand. I was there when Representative Carlson came with his amendments, and I think we did the right thing. And but I think that the real truth of whether we do the right thing depends upon how we take advantage of the resource and how we protect the oil industry and also the opportunities that exist for the people of North Dakota to take this state to some place where nobody's even dreamed it could be. And so I think we want to just be careful and move slow on some of these items, especially this oil tax extraction and production tax issues. And let's get through June and let's do some good planning, and then let's start talking about tax policy.
Further comments? Mr. Speaker.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I agree with a lot of the Honorable Senator from the East had to say there, and we certainly aren't going to take any action before June, but I still also think that it's very important that we study and learn as much as we can about our different taxes, and this happens to be a very important one right now, and the impact it has and potential and a little, I mean, our time is to study stuff and get educated, and I think it's a good opportunity for us to do it. We're not going to take any action before June, and we may not take any action at all, but still the knowledge is going to serve us well into the next session.
Okay, well, a visit with John, and we'll see if we can schedule it at some point. If we schedule it too early, we may forget it by the time we get to session. So, any further comments or considerations on the extraction tax? Okay, that takes us, I think, to the. The last agenda item, which is the beloved cigarette tax stamp issue. And committee, we received a invitation to tour in Bismarck here, a business that that stamps their cigarettes. And on behalf of the committee, I accepted that offer. So our next committee meeting will be a short tour of the business that provides these stamps. They thought it was important for our committee to see the process, and so we'll be doing that at our next meeting. Any further discussion on the cigarette tax stamp? Representative Hansen.
Get a copy of that bill we had.
was the proposal to stamp the cigarettes, and it was turned down, but turned into a study that this committee was to study, or?
Well, actually, the history goes several sessions back, but two sessions back, which in 07, there was a bill that would have required stamping. The bill was killed or turned into a study suggestion that wasn't prioritized. I don't remember which. And then there was a resolution for a study in 09, not given priority, and then this study directive that this committee is working with now. So the background memo runs through all of that, and once again, I don't have that with me.
Well, I don't have any further. We'll obtain the background memo again and the bill preparatory to going on our tour next time. The tentative plan is to meet again mid to late March. We won't be meeting in February. And so if you have any definite conflict dates in mid to late March, let us know and we'll try to schedule around them. But that's sort of the plan at this point. Any further business for the committee today?
Chairman.
Senator Cook.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I should have brought this up earlier on when you talked about committee direction, but we all were handed out earlier this morning a series of documents from Mrs. Lichty in Jamestown, and I think that we should spend some committee time on this. There's a few questions here raised. The question that she's asking this committee to discuss is the bill that we passed last session that expanded the role of the State Board of Equalization, and yet she's pointing out a role that she thinks they should have, and that's simply that they have the authority to require somebody who gets a building exemption to hold up to their end of the bargain. And I think that has merit. The other thing that catches my attention here, it's not a tax-related issue, but it's the ability for the North Dakota Health Department to give a assisted living facility license to a building when they're not providing any assisted living. And that's, you know, I'm not sure what the requirements are to have a license, but I look at it this way. If you're calling yourself an assisted living facility, you're probably listing your business in the yellow pages under assisted living, and yet you don't offer any assisted living. And, I think we should just get this on an agenda at some future meeting if we could, and maybe have somebody from Jamestown here to speak on behalf of why they did what they did, have Mrs. Lichty be able to explain what her concern is, and then maybe even have somebody from the State Board of Tax Equalization to explain what they feel their limitations were on this issue.
Yeah. I think the first suggestion, trying to figure out whether, because this fits into sales tax exemptions, which we're authorized to study, getting the State Board of Equalization to tell us, why do they somehow lack enforcement authority or manpower to enforce the directives that they put out. I think that would be a good item. The second one, I'm kind of torn by, because we have to study what we're authorized to study, and why a particular assisted living business can get or can't get a license based on their ability to meet the criteria in the statute is something that I think probably drifts away from our role as the taxation committee, and certainly what we've been authorized to study. But the first part of her concern, I think, is something we can take a look at. She was not able to be here this time, but I think under Senator Cook's suggestion, she'll have a standing invitation to come to the next one if she can, and we'll try to get a representative from the State Board of Equalization because this is a pretty big exemption that a lot of property owners take advantage of. Any other committee discussion? If not, we are adjourned. Thank you.
You take